Name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to see everybody. I want to thank, I think it was Sharon that asked me. Thanks her for asking me, and special thanks to the security scruff for not objecting once I got here. I appreciate that. So my sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. All of these wrinkles in my face are a direct result of you guys and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm from Covina, California. If you don't know where Covina is, if you are downtown Los Angeles at midnight and you point your car directly east, and it's midnight, it takes about 18 minutes to get to Covina. But if it's 3 in the afternoon, it'll take 2.5 hours. So that gives you an idea of where Covina is. And also, I haven't had a haircut in 2 years, and that's mainly because I don't have a woman in my life to tell me what to do. So I just decided to grow my hair out. Why not? So I'm an alcoholic. It's the most important thing I can tell you about myself. There's a lot of things I care about in this world that I have passion for, that I spend a lot of time paying attention to. But there's nothing more important than the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason that I believe I'm an alcoholic, it's very simple. It's because I've got a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. And the strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of the strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. Very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is what they refer to as something called the phenomenon of craving. The best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with absolutely nothing else that I drink. An example of that, I've got this bottle of water, and over the next 20 minutes to 8 hours that I'm talking with you, I know, just making sure you're paying attention. Over the next 20 minutes that I'm talking with you, I'll probably drink about half that bottle, and I'll finish it in, sometime in the next hour. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish that bottle of water, I am not going to go buy a case of water and lock myself in a cheap motel room, right? There's no chance of that happening. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction, this unquenchable thirst that happens, this loss of control that happens when I drink, if that was the sum total of my abnormal relationship with alcohol, well, they would have solved alcoholism in the early 80s when Nancy Reagan came out and said, just say no. If that would have worked, I would have. And I imagine you would have gone, oh, ha, no, and just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other really strange component of my abnormal relationship with alcohol. And what's really strange about this part of my relationship with alcohol is that this happens when I'm not drinking. I'm going to reemphasize that, and welcome to the new people. I'm going to reemphasize that if you happen to be new. This deadly, deadly component of my abnormal relationship with alcohol happens when I'm not drinking. Our book calls it the mental obsession. They also call it the strange mental blank spot, and they drive it even further home for a guy like me when they call it the thought process that precedes the first drink. They even call it the crux of the problem. The best way I can describe this thing that the book calls the mental obsession in my life is that it seems like no matter how much pain and suffering my last drunk caused, I seem to have a mind that will always paint a picture that makes it okay for me to take another drink. I seem to have a mind that will rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So therefore, because of these two components of my relationship with alcohol, number one, I cannot drink successfully because of this strange craving, this loss of control that happens once I drink. So I can't drink successfully. But at the very same time, because of this thing called the mental obsession, I cannot not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. So I set this abnormal relationship up with alcohol right from the get-go when I first started drinking. I started drinking very late compared to most people in AA. I was 11. I hung in there for a while. And I activated that right away. It became the most important thing in my life as a young teenager. And I'm just going to skip ahead because we just got 20 minutes done. And at 23 years old, after I'd flunked out of been kicked out of public and private schools, and barely scraped out of high school. My parents send me off to the university at 18 years old, and I spent 3 years at University of Washington, Washington State University, and Seattle U. And in 3 years, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content about a 0.25. Then at 23, a really bad night happened, and a really bad night. And so I joined the Navy. What I'm about to tell you should concern you if you care anything about the security of the United States. But on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test that qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that even maybe, possibly, or even remotely would allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. They call that test a urinalysis test, is what they call that one, and don't know how to study for those. Should have been kicked out of the Navy. Series of events allowed me to stay in. And, I did well while the ship was out at sea, but the ship would always pull into a port, and I would take a drink, and I would trigger off a 2 day, sometimes a 3 day, and every once in a while a 4 day drunk. And I got to tell you, when I'm on a 4 day drunk, but the ship is only in port for 2 days, we have got a math problem. It's a very strange feeling coming out of one of these 3 day drunks and finding myself on a large pier in a foreign country at 6 a.m. And I'm looking up and down that pier going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Navy gets very angry. Been in the Navy about 2 years at this point, and I came to in a cheap hotel room one more time. Monday, I realized it's Monday. Oh no, I started drinking on Thursday. Not again. No. And I grabbed my belongings, and I got in my car, which was also dying of alcoholism, right along with me. And I love my mail lady. She's wonderful. So I didn't want to be rude to her. So anyway, I grab my belongings, get in my car that's dying of alcoholism, racing back to the base, and lost control of my car. I was trying to get this pint in me because I know it's going to be a while till I get a drink. And I lost control of the car about 40 feet from the guard shack at the front of the Navy base, and I was still going 40 miles an hour, and I tried to swerve. The car hit this cement median on the right-hand side and flipped over and bang, right through that guard shack. And I'm so grateful United States Marines are in great shape. This young man did a quick somersault, back up, weapon drawn. God, I hated mornings like this. I really hated mornings like this. Sirens going off, everybody screaming and yelling and running in different directions and pointing at me like this is all my fault. And I climbing out of an upside down car feeling like I got questions too. What the hell just happened? God, I just really hated mornings like this. And stage two of mornings that I hated, about an hour later, I find myself in a hospital bed and I'm handcuffed to the hospital bed. I really hated mornings like this. Navy superiors were reading new charges on me. This is nothing significant in my life. That's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days. Most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called antabuse for me. And I now was under orders to show up at sick bay every single morning, and the hospital corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour. So once again, alcohol has been taken away from me. It's not the first time in my life. And when people who loved me or who had authority over me would take alcohol away from me, they would always put me in front of well-meaning, highly educated therapists, counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, and I'd have these one-on-one appointments, and they'd always look at me. They'd have some sort of report in front of them, and they'd look at me from that report, look down at the report, and they'd get this sour look on their face like, "What's the matter with you, son? What on earth? Don't you see what you're doing?" And if I would have had the vocabulary that you guys have given me here in Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 4 decades that I've been with you, I would have responded to these well-meaning people who are only trying to help me. I would have said, "I see that you're shocked by my drinking. I am too sometimes." But then I would have told them, "But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. There's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for my drinking, and that's the way that I feel when I'm not drinking." And I did not know how to verbalize that. Lasted about 10 days on this antabuse. I went AWOL from my ship, and I locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego. And I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass sitting on this rickety little end table in this cheap hotel room. And I remember that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse. They'd said, "Son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of Anabuse, you're going to get one of two reactions. One reaction is you'll get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die." I remember thinking, "Well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get." So I took one shot, and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, I was like hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. So I took another shot and up it came. My second sponsor was a man named Eddie Cochran, sobriety date December 2nd, 1951, one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. And he called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. It was literally like, huh! Kind of like Linda Blair in The Exorcist, right? This blow right across the room. And thank God the Plaza Hotel was the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. Maybe a design feature, I believe, maybe to make convicts feel more at home. I don't know. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse, and that is if you hang in there and I keep drinking and keep puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system and I'd quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating, and sweating. If you're going to drink on top of Anabuse, you may need to reach down deep inside yourself for a level of commitment you might not even know you have. So I drank on top of Anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. Last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail in handcuffs. One more time, neck muscles aren't working well. I'm being led around by the elbow. And finally, later that morning, after they processed me from the civilian authorities back to the military authorities, they tried to bring me back to the ship. And the officer deck put his arm up and said, "Wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser. Orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment." Now, it wouldn't have mattered what I thought about this apparent options going on because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but mine was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs never once did they ever turn to me and say, "So what's your opinion on what we're going to do next?" Right? I'm in handcuffs. So they took me up to this military treatment center. And when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. And I got to tell you, as far as I'm concerned, in the late 1980s, the United States Navy had one of the finest treatment centers in the world. It's not because they had some wonderful detox method or any extra special counseling. I'm sure that was all wonderful. The reason I thought it was so, now believe it's so amazing, is because 4 to 5 nights a week, white vans would pull up to those barracks. Six or seven of us would be thrown into each one of these white vans. Each of those vans would leave that base and go out into town, and they would bring us to you. I had the privilege of sitting in the backs of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with six or seven other military men and women, and I got to watch Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know there was a huge difference between watching Alcoholics Anonymous and doing Alcoholics Anonymous, but a couple of things really affected me while I watched you guys, and one of them was that every other time that society or somebody had taken alcohol away from me, remember I told you they put me in front of well-meaning, highly educated people who always wanted to talk to me about me. This time, alcohol has been taken away from me, and now I'm put in front of you guys. And you guys do not want to seem to talk to me about me at all. All you guys want to do is talk about yourselves. You would just go on and on and on about yourself, like I'm doing right now. But there was something in the way that you talked about yourself, especially your relationship with alcohol, and then even more so your relationship to the world when they took alcohol away, that I got this feeling of, oh my God, they know. They know. Now, if you would have been sitting next to me and nudged me, "Okay, kid, what is it that they know that you think you know how to gun?" I don't know. But they know. And the other thing that I noticed is I believed you were sober. I believed you had your 60 days. I believed you had your 6 months. I believed you had your 5 years. Now, I didn't understand why people still came here with 20 years. I didn't understand that concept yet. But I believed you were sober. And what baffled me is you guys seem to be happy about being sober. You seem to be like comfortable being sober. That was baffling to me. See, because I knew what sober was. This is what sober was. Hey, Carl, why aren't you drinking? I can't. They're on me again. I can't. That's what sober was. But you guys seem to wear it loosely. You seem to wear it with purpose. And not only did you seem excited about your sobriety, you would lose your mind over your friend's sobriety. You know, Joey's got 90 days. Ah! Right? It really affected me. It really, really did. So after 45 days, they let me out of that military treatment center, and they let me out, and I was my car was in this impound lot, and so I'm in my car and I'm leaving that base. And well, I'm gonna skip this part because we got it. I've only got 4 minutes. I got back to my ship, and one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He was 23 years old. He had 14 months of sobriety. He had a sponsor in port that had been hounding him to find somebody to work with. And so I was like gold being delivered to him on a silver platter. And he was going to work with me whether I wanted him to work with me or not. I was going to have to jump overboard to get away from this guy. And I spent my first 2 years of sobriety on that ship, Bob and I, right? I was 25, he was 23. And, you know, we traveled the world. And whenever the ship pulled into a port, we went and found you guys. We would leave that ship. We would have a phone number. We would use a pay phone, put in whatever currency or a calling card. We'd dial that number. Maybe a live person would answer. Maybe it would just be a recording with an address. And then we'd use a map, a real map. And we would go find that address. And there you guys were. But the ship also had to be out at sea for 2 and 3 weeks at a time. And we were both pretty still new. Neither one of us knew what we were doing. So that sponsor back in port again. Said every night we had to meet somewhere on that ship every night and read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous back and forth to each other. So every night at 6:30, we found this little battery shop down at the bottom of engine room number two, and we would read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous back and forth. And in my mind's eye, when I picture those two young men out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, down in the bottom of engine room number two of the USS Cushing, reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous back and forth, it's like Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. The blind leading the blind. Bob didn't know what he was. I was the first guy he really worked with. I didn't know what we were doing. But you know, we both had a desire to stay sober. I at least had a desire to not get in any more trouble. You know, whether it was an honest desire or not, I don't know. But we had the big book, we had the fellowship when we could access it, and what's supposed to happen happened. We both had a fundamental rearrangement of our attitudes and ideas towards life. And one of them, you know, there was a lot of little experiences over my first couple of years. One of them was when I got 1 year sober, right? Here in Southern California, people make a big deal out of your 1 year, and you get a cake, and all your friends show up, and meeting sings happy birthday really poorly. You know, you ever wonder why there's no AA choir? All you got to do is listen to us sing, especially on Zoom singing happy birthday. Oh my God, that's horrific. But you know, at 1 year, we were out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It was January 21st, 1988, when I had 1 year. And Bob, my first sponsor, ran up to the mess deck on the ship and stole a stale piece of cornbread and brought it down on a little tray. And there was no candles on the ship, so he flicked a wood match. He put it on there and he sang, "Happy birthday to you." Just as, and then I blew out the match. And then Bob said, "Would you like to share?" And it was just as lame as it sounds. It was even more lame than it sounds. But I got to tell you, later that night, laying in my rack in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, I had an experience that is these things of spiritual rearrangement are hard to really put to words. But best way I can describe it, I laid there and I realized my life is a mess. I'm still facing all sorts of charges here with the military. I've got a lot of charges back in port. I forgot to tell you about this embezzlement scam that I didn't know how to get out of. And my family still would not even really talk to me, right? They weren't even really believing that I was sober. And the reason that they had a hard time believing I was sober is because I had trained them to think that way. My life was a mess, but you know what? I knew I had 1 year sober. No matter what else was going on, I had 1 year sober. And I realized, oh my God. So that's what they mean by that's the most important thing. It's the only thing I could hold on to is that I truly had 1 year without a drink. 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That's the result of the ninth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe me, I could do an hour workshop on letting you know everything that I had to do in order to clean things up enough to get an honorable discharge out of the Navy with it, like a glowing recommendation when I got out. It's, well, actually, how that happened was the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a Navy clerk that lost half my file. That's how that really happened. Kind of just teasing. But one of the amends I still couldn't make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents, remember, they paid for that bachelor's degree over like 3 or 4 years, and I had nothing to show for it. And my first sponsor, Bob, he didn't know what he to, he didn't, right? Remember, he didn't know what to do, and he goes, God will show us. And the grand sponsor got involved. It's never good when the grand sponsor gets involved in these important life decisions. He knew exactly what had to happen. He said, son, you have two choices. You either have to pay your parents back every single nickel they wasted on your education, or you have to go get what they paid for in the first place. So I wound up in this town called Covina in late 1989, early 1989. I had 2 years of sobriety fresh out of the Navy and found this little Alano club here for meetings. But I tried to explain that that's when I met my next sponsor, because Bob still had to stay in the Navy, and met my next sponsor. I'd mentioned him earlier, Eddie Cochran. He met me at the very first meeting I walked into. And he said, son, never seen you here before. What you doing? And I said, sir, it's nice to see your meeting hall here. I'm 2 years sober. I'm fresh out of the Navy. I'm gonna be going to school. I'm gonna be working. I gotta be self-supporting. I'm gonna be very, very busy, but I'll stop by some meetings when I get a chance. And he had this little chuckle that I heard so many times later. He, ha, ha. And I'll end with this. He gave me the Gettysburg Address. He said, son, school and work are wonderful things for a young man to do. In between meetings. Son, please do not try to fit us in between. Try to, son, learn how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world. Do not try to hash it out there in the real world and only visit Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have lived by that code for the last 4 decades, and it served me well. Thank you very much for letting me share.
Wow.